This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Sam Cooney. I'm a writer, I'm an editor, I teach at a couple of universities, and I help run a literary publishing organisation called The Lifted Brow. Now, this event is about meat, about why we eat it, about how we eat it, and everything in between. Discussions around meat tend to gravitate quickly towards polar positions. We often talk in terms of total abstinence, vegetarianism or veganism, or unexamined kind of risk of abandon, especially in this country, especially in maybe the last couple of decades. It's polarised even more. Tonight we'll be discussing cultural, environmental and health implications of eating meat and our general dietary choices, although it will always revolve around meat and meat eating. We'll try and not answer, perhaps, but dig into the question of should we eat less meat? Why and how could we do this if we did want to eat less meat? Should we be eating meat better? And what would a more mindful approach to eating meat look like, and how might it alter our social lives and our identities? Now, I'm going to briefly introduce our guests, just brief bios, because they have bios as long as my arm, and that would take up another five. We don't want that. Please know that we'll go for about 40, 45 minutes here up on stage, and then there will be 15 minutes at the end for questions. So anytime during tonight, if you have a burning question or if you've already walked in with one and you're just waiting for question time, hold on to it. There'll be a couple of Wheeler Centre staff who will be walking around with microphones. Please, if you don't mind, just wait until they come around and hand you the mic, because this event is being recorded and we'd like to capture your beautiful voice. Without further ado, I will introduce the three speakers here tonight and stop talking as much myself, because you're not here to see me, that's for sure. Far side of the stage, we have Richard Cornish. Richard's an award-winning writer whose love of the land leads him to explore the issues around food, where it comes from, how it gets to us, and why it tastes so good. His most recent book is titled My Year Without Meat. I've got it here in my hand. You'll see me flash it a few times tonight, I'm sure. In the middle here, we have Tammy Jonas. She was a vegetarian academic and is now Mistress Meatsmith. That's not me calling her that, by the way. That's in capital letters, her own title, at John I. Farms, where she and her family of Ethicurean farmers raise pastured rare breed pigs and cattle on 69 acres of volcanic paddocks just outside of Daylesford. Tammy's been writing about food since 2006 on her blog, and she's been widely published in many academic and popular texts. And on my immediate left here, Sam Van Sweden. She's a writer of creative nonfiction and poetry, published very widely as well. Her work in progress, titled Eating With My Mouth Open, was recently shortlisted for the Scribe Nonfiction Prize for Young Writers. Her writing is most often interested in memory, family, food and mental health. So as you see here, we have quite an interesting combination of people here. I thought, first of all, before anything else, I would ask our three panelists just what their current eating practices are in regards to meat eating. So perhaps, Sam, you want to start? Just give us a quick...
Sure. At the moment, I am a meat eater. I have to say, over the last few weeks, I've cooked and eaten a lot less meat because I've been forced to think about it. But on the whole, I'm not a particularly mindful meat eater. And it feels uncomfortable to say that.
Yep, I am sure we're going to get into this a lot tonight, the idea that if we turned our brains on to the subject, I think with anything, but with meat eating, it changes our practices, which is scary to think, because often we like to think that we are doing what we want and doing it mindfully until we suddenly realise we're not.
Yep.
Tammy?
I currently consider myself an ethical omnivore. I try not to eat too much meat, like not every day. And where most people say, how can you eat an animal you knew? I usually turn that around and say, I try not to eat animals I didn't know. So I'm mostly vegetarian when I'm not at home, and I eat meat at home.
Yeah. And Richard?
I ate meat today. and I ate meat yesterday too. I've just come back from Germany, and vegetarianism there is quite well developed, but only in some parts of the country. So I did eat my body weight in sauerkraut and dumplings. Today lunch, I was craving broad beans, I was craving asparagus. They're in season right now, and I went to a restaurant that was serving, I knew they'd have them on the menu, with an editor I work for. They pay me, and they wanted to have steak. They wanted to have Wagyu steak from a farm that I despise, and I had to suck it up because that's what they wanted. I ate lots of veg, really good beetroot, some really, really lovely fish dishes, but there was this shitty Wagyu on a plate that I ate without savour.
I hope they don't watch this, Richard.
Sounds horrible. We all feel for you, yeah. I myself am... I'm a lapsed vegetarian insofar as I eat meat rarely, but when I do so guiltily and then afterwards wonder why. But that's not, you don't need anyone to know about my feelings. maybe I'll just put it out there today. I was telling the guys in the back room here, I had to put down a chook this morning that had been ill for a few weeks, which I felt like was very... very coincidental and maybe augured something that I maybe shouldn't have turned up tonight, but we'll see. But if I seem a bit shaky, that's just because I'm nervous, nothing to do with the chicken at all. But Richard, you just mentioned then that you're craving asparagus and broad beans, which I've never had that particular craving so much that I had to run out. But perhaps you could talk about your book, because I know that your book opens with a particular scene of craving. Can you tell us a little bit about your book and how it came about, and maybe with that scene start off there?
Okay. Thanks, Sam. And congratulations on killing a chook. I think if an animal is suffering, you're doing the right thing. If I think we should all... anyone here killed an animal, by the way? Anyone killed an animal for food? Anyone seen animals being killed? Okay, and those of you who haven't seen animals being killed, okay, and those of you who do it for pleasure, only joking, sorry.
And for those of you watching at home, there were several hands went up at several different stages there. So.
Okay, I'm a food writer. I write for the Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. I write about food, and at one stage I was their meat correspondent because the editor, Veronica Ridge, was vegetarian, and she felt that she could not do her job properly without having some foot in the game. And so she seconded that job to me, and I took that way too seriously. And I was simply, you know, I had a freezer full of meat and lined up like a library with different growers. You know, there would be different provenance, etc. And I would go, okay, cool. Like a wine writer would have a library full of wine so they can cross-reference. And I was writing a book at a friend's place, finishing up near your way, Tammy, and up in Glen Lyon. And I was belting out a few chapters of a book, and I decided to make dinner that night, which was going to be a whole four quarter of lamb that I roasted in their agar, and in went down a layer of rosemary and garlic, and this four quarter of shoulder of lamb from Wanky's Butchery in Dalesford, you know, the Wanky brothers. Yep, got it from them, and this was slow roasting all day. The smell of roast lamb permeating the house. If flavours can be brown, this aromas can be brown. This was a brown aroma penetrating the house, and the phone call from home, and one of the children was sick. I had to go home. My friend with whom I was staying said, take the lamb with you. I will not eat it by myself. She wrapped the lamb in some glad wrap, put down a layer of the Weekly Times onto the front seat of the Hilux ute, and then clipped the safety belt over it as a little comic coda, tapped the roof of the Hilux and sent me on my way. I was driving between Glen Lyon and Malmesbury. It's a thin black line of tarmac that cuts through the forest there, and then it opens up into this really cold country. It was wintertime, and that smell of brown aroma of meat was getting stronger and stronger, and I was getting hungrier and hungrier, and there was an hour and a half of road back to Melbourne, and I found my fingers wandering across, Sam, into the piercing their way through the plastic, and found myself just pulling a small piece of meat out and driving along at the same time. That wasn't enough. I pulled over. I stopped the car. I took the tin of roast lamb out and I put it on the bonnet of the car. And I found myself, this has not been mindful. I found myself, getting tranches of meat and pulling it out away from the scapula and stuffing it into my face. It was two things brought me back to where I was. One was the congealed blobs of fat on the bonnet of the car. It was that cold. And the second one was the sound of a diesel bus coming along the road. Just those, you know, just like that time of the year, 4 o'clock on a winter's day, the lights are bobbing up and down. And then it slowed down because it's quite a thin road. And there I looked up and there was a busload of school children looking down on me, their faces pressed against the window of the bus, and I realised then that I had a problem with meat.
And so what was your problem? Was your problem that, and did it have to do with meat specifically?
Well, there's no AA for meat. There's no Betty Ford for meat in Australia. So I took it upon myself then to go, okay, bang, absence. And then open up a new world of what do I do? Okay, how do I get nutrition? How do I get enough iron? How do I get enough protein? That's a reductionist point of view. Why do we like meat? Why did I find myself in that position? Do you know that we're actually hardwired to like amino acids, like glutamate? Amino acid, MSG is the BABA to the ABBA. It's the cover band that we make in the factories. We're hardwired to detect that stuff. It is something that is so intrinsic to who we are. It is actually who we are. We love amino acid, which is found so readily and so available and so predominant in meat that we are hardwired to crave amino acids. And so this is what when you do something, you go on one of these immersion journeys, this is what you start to discover.
Right. And how was that year?
It was more than a year. Yeah. It turned out to be 18 months. There was an incident involving lamb. I was cooking for a friend's 50th birthday. And it was involving a bottle and a half of Pinot Noir. And I did wake up and there was half a shoulder of lamb missing when I woke up the next morning. And I thought, well, if the Catholics can do it in the 1500s and put ducats into gold ducats into a wooden box and let souls fly out of purgatory, then I think I can just do another 6 months and give myself an indulgence like that.
Right. And that year without meat was not veganism. It was not byproducts of animals, but just the flesh of an animal.
Flesh, yeah, yeah. Just flesh. But I also went and had a looked at dairy because there was a debate like this put on by the Wheeler Centre, Intelligence Squared, run also by the St James Ethical Centre, and which Veronica Ridge, the editor, who's a really strong vegetarian, she said, oh, we had so much great vegetarian food. It was really, really good. And I went to this restaurant and you can have great food and there's this really good dish with potatoes and cheese. At that moment, the Twittersphere broke. It's like 2,000 people, a lot of them were vegans in that room, hit Twitter and just went bang. She's lost it. You know, she's lost the debate in the room because she's mentioned the word cheese and dairy. And I went out with a dairy farmer and just worked out, you know, that dairy equals dead calves. You know, to make dairy, for every litre of milk, there's a lot of dead calves produced. And that's the nasty secret of the dairy industry as well. Mm. So it worked that out. That was part of the situation as well. But I really feel like I'm talking too much.
Yeah. That's all right. I was just about to move away from you anyway.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put you on the spot.
So, Richard, no. Tammy, tell us a little bit about your, I'm going to use the J word, journey. You wrote down that you had been a mindless industrial eater, then become a vegetarian, to an ethical omnivore and a mindful meatsmith, which is where you find yourself now. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the short points of that are that I was raised on industrial food, you know, so Oscar Mayer bologna in America is a thing. There apparently are animal products in that, and they don't come from very happy animals, and that was really standard for us growing up in California and Oregon. We'd have Wonder Bread and Oscar Mayer bologna and Kraft cheese singles slices and mayonnaise, and that was and that bright yellow mustard, French's mustard, isn't it? So that's what I grew up on. And then in 91 I read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, and I learned about the conditions of industrial animal agriculture, and I was so horrified that the only response I could sort of make to it was to give up eating meat entirely. However, like Richard, I didn't give up dairy and eggs. In fact, I still didn't know the stories of the dairy and egg industry until later. I came back to eating meat some years, well, sort of 10 years later, when I was pregnant for the third time. I'd had two very successful vegetarian pregnancies where I'd had to have some supplements towards the end, but really was proving, you know, to everyone that I didn't need that. Vegetarians can have healthy babies. And the third one, I got so anemic that no supplement would fix it. And I was actually working in Smith Street, and I thought, a burger would fix this. And I hadn't had any flesh at that time in 7 years. And I just walked down the street to one of the little takeaway shops, and I ordered a burger like a crazy woman. I'm like, can I have a burger? He said, right. What do you want on it? No sauce. I hate tomato sauce. Do you have any hot English mustard? He's like, yeah. And then I stood near the counter, and I just ate the whole thing. And I swear I felt immediately better. And so I came back to eating red meat once or twice a week for that pregnancy. Still didn't eat pork or poultry for a very long time. Not until actually somebody involved in that IQ2 debate, Fiona Chambers from Fernley Farms, not until I found her rare breed ham was when I started eating pork again. Because you can visit her farm, or you could then. And then our journey was to land on the farm in 2011. I'd been writing and worrying at questions in the food system, in particular the treatment of animals, since 91. And so in 2011, we went to the farm to be free-range pig farmers because it's very hard. Probably everyone in this room would have some experience of trying to buy genuine free-range meat, or whether it's maybe some of you aren't, there'll be some who don't want to engage with that at all, but I'm sure most here have. We thought, well, there should be more free-range pork made available to help people make that choice more readily. And we think the countryside should be populated with farmers like us growing the animals the way we do. The butcher part sort of came more by surprise because it's just a problem for small-scale livestock producers to find a reliable butcher and who can process your animals for you regularly, and then you sell your meat directly to people. Plus, the regulations are pretty tricky once they do the butchering and you want to get it to the public. So the obvious being Jonah. Our last name is Jonas, so collectively we're the Jonai. It's just a bad Latin play. What the Jonai do whenever there's an irresolvable problem is say, well, we'll just do that too. So I retrained as a butcher, and that's why I'm the Mistress Meatsmith at Jonai Farms. And it's actually been great because of I was a good cook before, but I wasn't a particularly good meat cook because I had so many years of vegetarianism, and becoming a butcher has taught me more than I ever knew about cooking meat and how to be very resourceful and not waste things. And I now can teach all of our CSA members who buy our meat how to do what we do because I know so much about it. So that's a short version.
That is very short. I know how much there is behind there. Did you have to do a course in butchery, or how did you? Wasn't off YouTube or something, was it?
A fair bit was off YouTube. Yes. Well, no, I actually sort of informally apprenticed myself to the butcher we did find to cut for us for 6 months.
Right.
And we were just doing two pigs a fortnight at the time. So I'd go after my day job to him. I'd meet him at about 6:30. He would have also had a full day in there. And then we'd cut two pigs, and then I'd take them home with the pig's head in the seat next to me, actually, with this whole plan, because I'm not a slow driver. So I had this whole plan for if I got pulled over, I was going to say, that's what I do to pigs. My husband thought it was a terrible idea, by the way.
Yeah. I was going to say, I was glad that the police didn't come when Richard was on the side of the road, and I'm glad the police didn't pull you over when you had pig's head in your car. But there you are on that image, Sam.
Sam.
Now, you come at this topic as a storyteller.
I do, yes.
Yeah. How does storytelling and meat eating or meat intertwine for you, both, you know, personally, but also maybe intellectually, as somebody who's has written and is writing about this kind of stuff?
Sure. So, yeah, I have written and am writing about food generally, and how food is significant in our lives, the stories that we tell around food, and how the significance that we build around food makes the relationships that we have with it particularly complex and almost anything but that. I suppose that myth of it's just fuel, because it's almost anything but that. So for meat, I think that's a particularly compelling place to unpack those stories, because we have to contend with questions about our own bodies and what we see of ourselves reflected in the source of meat. And also what, I suppose there's a lot of assumptions that we make around our meat eating that we just don't question. So it's about what stories we can unpack and recognise as stories and as sort of culturally built up around meat, rather than just that's how we eat.
Hmm. You mentioned seeing ourselves reflected in the meat that we eat. You wrote a piece about offal.
I did.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. At the end of last year, Adam Liao spoke at the Interrobang events for the Wheeler Centre, and he brought up the idea of food trends not being particularly useful because they bank on rarity. They indulge the whims of a privileged few, and they don't really recognise the global food situation. And it got me thinking about, I suppose, the nose-to-tail movement and how there's sort of a line where you can, okay, cool, I can make carrot top pesto, that's fine, but I can't, there's a line that a lot of people have trouble crossing when it comes to using all of an animal. And I couldn't, like, I sort of wanted to nut out exactly what that was, and the best I could come up with was that it's about the fact that so many of the things that are inside animals are inside of us as well, and they look the same, and we recognise that, and that's quite confronting. It's quite a different thing to receiving a steak that's on a, you know, on a tray and wrapped in glad wrap. It's much more sort of unnerving. And also our language is hugely wrapped up in what's inside of us. So, like, the metaphors that we use around, you know, having gut feelings or, you know, brokenhearted and that sort of thing, that's all those pieces. So we're hugely invested in what those pieces mean to us, that then to be given them on a plate is... It's a lot. It's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. I'm glad you brought up language, because I know that this is something you've written about before, Richard, and something you're interested in. You mentioned lamb before, but then beef. So one is called one thing and one's called another. We talk about steak. Offal has some incredibly creative or different ways to describe it or name it. How does the way we describe or talk about meat and meat eating, Richard, affects the actual our view of it, perhaps, and does it allow us to get away with things maybe that we are trying to avoid, or is it just more of an evolution of language?
Well, there's definitely obfuscation in language, the way we describe things, but also the descriptions as well. When you're talking about the inside of animals, when you vivisect an animal, when you take an animal apart, and you do see what's inside of an animal, knowing what's inside of you, they're so beautiful. It's an amazing thing, those organs, the colours, the complexity, the beauty, the amazement. It is truly beautiful opening up at the inside of an animal. To look at them, there's some of the best still lifes. Rembrandt painted them, the insides of animals and game animals. It was just, to me, it's if I was a Christian, I'd say it's a miracle, but it is truly amazing. I think it's a privilege to be able to do that and appreciate it, but also appreciating the language as well. Then we do use obfuscation. Sorry, I'm jet lagged. The word abattoir, for example, is in itself a euphemism. They used to be called, I think there was another French word that you probably know, Tammy, that actually used the word blood in it, sangateur or something like that. And so the French didn't like this word, and so they actually created a new word called abattoir. And even our words that we use for meat have class and obfuscation and labour division inside them. If you look at the word for lamb, as you said, Sam, a lamb comes as a Germanic word. It comes from our Saxon background. But if you look at the word for the lamb as the animal, it also refers to the young animal. But the on the tables, because you didn't actually eat that many lambs, you'd actually eat the older animals. And a word that was used in the tables after the Norman conquest by the people who were in power. The people in power used the word mutton, which is a French word. And so you have this division already of labour and of class, and the people who are doing the farming and the killing, they were calling them lambs. The people doing the eating and enjoying, they were calling it mutton. The same with beef. You know, the cow is the Germanic word, but beef is the French word. Hurst is the German word, but deer is another word we use for that animal. But when it hits the plate, it becomes venison. Venison, which actually comes from with its Latin root, got the word hunter in there. It's a hunted food. It talks about the grandeur of hunting. So when we talk about meat, we've got this, we obfuscate the thing that sits at the base of every single piece of meat we put in the mouth, which is there is a death of an animal. A death of an animal by human hands. These animals do not die naturally. You had put down the chicken today, Sam. You would not eat that chicken because it was ill. There's no culture that eats ill animals. You kill an animal when it's at its best. And seeing an animal, I don't think any animal wants to go to its death. I've been to abattoir, I've killed animals myself. They are terrified. And this, when you talk about the ethics, is what ethics are you prepared to live with? Are you prepared to eat an animal that has been terrified and screaming and kicking and knowing it is about to be killed because it can smell blood and there is blood in the abattoir, in the kill room? Can you handle that? If you don't see it, probably can. You probably can handle it, you know. And that's. But I think that's where that act of killing has been removed. We do not see it. It's in a box. It's in a box inside a big building behind a fence. You are not welcome to go there. You will not be invited to go there, and it's not part of our normal day-to-day life. And there's that expression that always comes up: if abattoirs had glass walls, there'd be much fewer people eating meat. But I reckon if abattoirs had glass walls, the meat industry would definitely change. It would find a way of killing animals more humanely.
Mm. You have to kill animals for meat, and you have to do so humanely, and that's obviously a huge part, the main part of your practice. When you were a vegetarian, was it an ethical decision, an environmental decision? Was it a social decision, or was it a combination? And how did you move from there to eating meat? You talked about eating meat while pregnant. Did you have to reevaluate your ethics or your understanding, or did you have to do a lot of study and reading, or how did you make that leap?
Yeah, I think the biggest stump for me still is the abattoir, because they, I agree. I don't think there's a good example of a situation of loading an animal on a trailer and taking them to an abattoir. There's just none of them are really good. Like, for example, ours I think is as good as an industrial abattoir gets for pigs, but it's still an industrial abattoir, and they're scared as they go down the line. So that still bothers me. Mm-hmm. And as per Richard's point, I guess, when I came back to eating meat, that was the point I negotiated, that I had to accept that there were things in the system I don't like, but I don't have another option unless I go back to vegetarianism, mm-hmm. in which case, to be fully consistent, I'd have to be vegan except for eggs that I grew in my own backyard, I suppose, when I was still in the city. But I still, as a pig farmer, think about like quitting the whole thing, you know, withdrawing from the whole system until we can kill on farm. Because the one way you can kill them where there's no fear is where you walk up to an animal in the paddock and you drop them in the paddock and they didn't...
Assassinate them.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's, and they didn't know it was going to happen.
Yeah, seriously. Like, if you want to go, like, if do you want to know you're going to die? There's a lot of flight and fight that's going through your system, and a lot of tension and a lot of really dark stuff going, if you think about it, which us writers have to do to produce stuff that, you know, that's palatable for people to read. But I met these dudes from Denmark, and they're from an island called Bornholm, and they have these indigenous autochthonous cattle that roam the island. They go into the forest and they have to have hunters to bring them down, and they're assassinated. They don't know it's coming. And they're like, oh wow, that is, I've got to tell Tammy about that one. That's if you're going to go, they don't know it's coming, bang, there's light in an instant, there's darkness once more. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, the problem is those of us who are so concerned with these things, if we just keep exiting the system, we never fix it.
I was just about to ask
so
you.
So when I run into that concern, I go, no, you've got to stay in.
Yeah. Would you consider, like, could you be a vegetarian butcher? Is there such a thing? Do you know of anybody?
I've actually said many times, never trust a vegetarian butcher.
Yeah, right.
I mean, sure, yep. But I don't know that it would be consistent, because it's not just about my own personal decision about what I'm putting in my body, it's about what I would be prepared to cut up and feed to others.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking along the lines of staying in the system and doing a better job than the majority big players and leading the way.
But I wouldn't ask people to eat what I won't eat.
Yeah.
So that's, I am important. Prepared to eat what we are having slaughtered, because I know that they've had a really great life. You know, I was just showing my family, who have just arrived from America, and I was out showing them the pigs on the paddocks, and, you know, they're like, this is amazing. You know, look at them sort of running around in this. You see those pictures of the sheds, and if you ever see pigs on a paddock, you'll never want to eat the alternative again, because in my eyes, when I look in those pictures of sheds, or I've been in the sheds, and it's even worse when you're there, because the smell and the sound is awful. And so when you see them on the paddocks, you go, they're these normal animals like the rest of us, who really appreciate the opportunity to be free and to eat grass and to play and to run and do all of the normal things that animals do. So I think people like us have to stay in the system while we reform it.
I think in the meat industry, death is not part of the meat industry, because the meat industry does not use the word death. They use the euphemism process. Even mates of mine, great mate of mine, Neil Prentice, he makes some of the best wine, he grows the best grass-fed Wagyu in Australia, perhaps the world, but even in conversations like this, he will not use the word slaughter in this situation, he uses the word process, because it's so deeply ingrained in the industry. And And that's the meat industry. I support farmers. I support farmers like Tammy. She's one of the few ones who uses the word slaughter and death. The rest of them use process, because they don't want to go back to that situation, to allude to the situation of that slaughter box, that little dark room, that little dark room of horrors. And because they don't want to use that word and remind you of it. And until they do, that word, death and slaughter, those concepts, death, slaughter and meat, is owned by the far left of the meat industry. The far left of the meat discussion, and Animals Australia, Voiceless, etc., who do, some of them do have an agenda to to actually close down the meat industry, and in their value system, it is perfectly right to do so, because there are so many problems with the killing of animals, and so they're the one who owns the concept of death in the meat industry. And the meat industry does not own the concept. They do not. It's like the mining industry avoiding the word truck or digger. It is so intrinsic to the industry, but they don't even own the concept, which to me I find is an amazing failure of an industry.
Sam, you mentioned that in your thinking and in your prep for this event, and I'm sure the same thing happens when you're writing about meat, and when you were writing about offal, that you found yourself eating less meat.
Mm.
Do you believe, and you know, you're not an expert in any way, but do you think that even if an animal is raised in ideal conditions, it is wrong, or is it okay for us to consume an animal for sustenance?
No, I think it's okay, and I guess what I would most like is just that people think, right, and that we create an atmosphere that encourages people to think. Like Richard sort of said, if you knew, you wouldn't be okay with it. And I think that, like, while, so for the last sort of 3 weeks or a month, I've been reading Richard's book and revisiting Jonathan Safran Foer's book about eating animals, and I've been showing up to lunch dates and having these books on the table, and my friends show up, and then there's this sort of weird thing that hangs over, like, so what are you ordering, and making everybody feel generally a bit uncomfortable.
It's like every meal with me.
It's fun. But the amount of people that said to me during that time, like, oh, I'd like to read that, but I'm scared it would turn me vegetarian.
Right. Yeah.
So I think we know these things.
Yeah.
We just don't want to look at them.
Yeah.
So if we, and I've been thinking about the Stephanie Alexander program for growing vegetables in schools, and how empowering that is for kids, knowing where their food comes from and what they can do with it, and how they how they can use it sustainably and stuff, and whether it would even be possible to do something analogous with meat, where we're introducing the language to people when they're very young around exactly what those processes are, so that we're making informed decisions about, like, we've thought about it.
Mm.
They tried that in Dalesford. There was the guy, what's his name?
Gary
Thomas. Gary Thomas tried that at the Dalesford Secondary School, and the producer of Babe got involved in the debate, and there were people pulled their kids out of school because they're raising a pig to be slaughtered. And he had guts, such guts to be able to pull that through.
Mm.
And it was an amazing story for him to be able to do that with the kids. And the kids, just like any society, some kids didn't want it to happen. Other kids went, yeah, okay, we're going to eat it. And the thing is, it wasn't just killing, but it was actually cooking together. It was the whole process, not just the point of slaughter, but actually what they're going to do with everything. And a lot of these family are Ticinese. They're from the Swiss Italians, and they were going to make sausages with it. And so they're going to put that back into a cultural context as well. They ended up killing the pig. But they didn't replicate the exercise as well.
Sounds like such an amazing special thing to do.
And there was a teacher in the UK a couple of years ago who got in trouble. I think she was suspended briefly because of complaints from parents for showing students actually just a video. Didn't take them to the abattoir. Just showed them video of a slaughter.
Hmm.
And I just would really like someone like her to put it to those parents who had such a fit about it. You know, are you vegetarian?
Mm.
Because if you are, then you get to turn your face away from slaughter. If you're not, you need to suck it up.
Mm.
Sorry.
I think something really amazing happens I was vegetarian when I was in my adolescence and young adulthood, so sort of 13 to 20, and I think a lot of that came about because I had a reaction to that sort of stuff. The internet had just come into my house, and I was sort of watching videos and reading stuff and going, oh my God. But I think that my reaction was pretty regular for young people. Young people have a really finely tuned awareness of what's just and what's fair and how things go down. Like, I eat meat now, and I think it's just a matter of forgetting and living in a thing that allows you to forget.
Complicity.
Yeah.
Complicity.
Yeah.
But I think it's where your ethics sit. I've got a real problem with ethical meat, by the way, Tammy, and I really... Ethical meat, but ethical for whom? You know, right. There'll be a vegan in this room who think ethical.
For him, it's not.
It's not ethical. And then there'll be people who don't give a stuff, thinking it's absolute bollocks and completely trash it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's ethics because it's no. We don't have. We have general ethics around meat. We have general ethics as a culture, but splintered across different ideas.
I don't think ethical meat is a perfect term. It's sort of the best one we've been able to come up with in this last, you know, however many years.
But what was that term, say again?
Ethical meat or ethically raised meat. As we know, terms like free range or pastured and those things get co-opted and used by those who are not doing what we do, so they're problematic. Ethical for me is the best, you know, some of my academic grounding is in philosophy, and ethics are about philosophies and they're about philosophical wonderings and philosophical challenges, and there's no just kind of absolute right and wrong when you're having philosophical discussion. So for me, ethical meat remains the best way to describe what we're doing because it is an open phrase. I can be challenged by a vegan and I understand that they don't agree that it's ethical. Like that's totally fine. And that someone else will be like, what makes it ethical? And then it's an opportunity to tell them about why we think it is. So it doesn't shut down a conversation. It doesn't answer it fully. It creates a space for conversation.
Tammy, are there any...
No, I just thought I'd throw it out there.
Are there any regulatory sort of guidelines around the term of ethical meat in the same way that there are for other... Okay.
Coles are looking at it at present.
Here we go. Right.
No, there's not even really around... there is a little bit around free range and outdoor bred, but that's not in... It's not like it's in legislation. They're definitions that are set up by the peak pork industry mostly. And the ACCC recently came down on people calling things bred free range or calling stuff that was outdoor bred where the sows are outdoors and the growers are in sheds. And so we only seem to get at these things by using the capitalist tools at our disposal. So anti-competition, you know, if it's anti-competitive, we can stop them. If it's just sort of about the ethics of the situation, no.
I like the butcher I spoke to who has a free-range butchery who was, because he couldn't get enough free-range pork, he was selling outdoor bred pork as free-range. So these pigs, I've seen how they're raised. They're raised in great big barns about the size of this room. Probably a bit more, probably too many pigs that would see normally in any natural environment. But he was selling them as free-range. But his business is based on free-range.
That happens all the time.
What a tosser.
And actually, that's an interesting thought experiment. So, yeah, those eco sheds, they call them, in the outdoor bred system, which is hands down a higher welfare system for pigs than the old industrial intensive, which are on concrete or slatted floors. And just the conditions are better. The sheds are open-ended. I still wouldn't eat it, and I don't promote it. But if people are making their choices,
I wouldn't have a problem
it's
eating.
Better.
I wouldn't have a problem eating.
Right. Yeah, but you told us we get for lunch. But as a thought experiment, if you took this shed and you thought about it with open ends, and if there are 200 people in this room, there would be more than 200 pigs in that in that same amount of space, and it feels, you know, fairly close. It's actually also quite warm in here. Now imagine you don't get to leave this space until you actually hold off for slaughter. So you spend your whole life in this kind of crowd, and this is the better example. The more crowded conditions, you're actually shoulder to shoulder, the whole room, you never get to do. It's hard to even turn around. And actually, if you're unlucky enough to be a sow, you're in what looks sort of like a cattle crush, and you spend quite a large part of your life in that crush. And to sit down, you have to roll down the crate with your back. So they usually have open wounds on the back on their backs from rubbing down and then back up.
Mm.
It's pretty awful stuff.
It's your turn. If you have a question, chuck up your hand. One of our roving mics will come your way. I've got plenty more here if there are no questions, but if there are any out there and you have it, you can ask the three panelists or anyone individually. Chuck up your hand. And if you don't mind, when asking a question, if you could just state your name and where you're from, just so it doesn't become some kind of weird one-way thing where it's a stranger shouting out from the void. So thanks.
Hi, I'm Sophie. I'm from Melbourne. I work in the health industry, actually. And I was just wondering, for me, it's a lovely discussion about ethical meat, but for a lot of people, it's completely unaffordable. And this is really just a comment. I think that if you can afford to eat ethically produced meat, then you should. But my question is actually about kangaroo, because you were talking about the beautiful assassination of animals. Is that how kangaroo is produced in Australia? And is that the only meat really that's available to the public, which is killed in that manner?
I've been out kangaroo shooting with the professional roo shooters. The animals produced for meat in New South Wales will probably be about 99% clean headshot. It's what they do with the joeys that poses a problem. If there's a joey in the pouch, it's killed by smashing its head on a rock. So, you know, they've got this amazing, great, wonderful, lean, green meat that's probably harvested in the best possible... they're there in headlight, bang, lights are out. But it's the death of the joey, and if they... until the industry can work that out, they're going to still have pushback from the other, from anyone actually. I don't think it's right to kill an animal like that, the joys like that. I will argue that ethical meat is not more expensive. I did a comparison between ethical meat and meat from the supermarket, cut for cut, and the prices are roughly equivalent if they're not on sale or discounted. So about $10 a kilogram for mince is the price in both ethically raised meat and the supermarket, unless it's been discounted by the supermarket, at $5 to $8 a kilogram. And, for example, chops across here would be about these chops here. Those ones there.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, I can't reach them. I'm too fat. They're roughly about, I look at the supermarket, they're about $30 a kilogram, and you can actually get some of the ethical growers are producing, are selling them for less. It's all about priorities and expectation.
Can I add to
yeah,
that?
I just one of my questions as well, which you can jump in on, was that Sam and I aren't, you know, people who work in the industry, and most people here probably aren't either. How does one go about, you know, in a way that doesn't involve us spending 5 years researching or being in the industry, how does one go about buying ethical meat that doesn't cost an arm and a leg? Because there are places out there that will charge extraordinary amounts for it. How does one go about that? Are there some resources out there for these kinds of...
Yeah, well, the best resource I can actually recommend is something called Flavor Crusader. You should write that down, called flavorcrusader.com. She's a... Sharon Lee writes that, and she does very careful research about the farms that she puts on there. She brings all of them to ask about their production methods and where they're selling. So she's got it for every state in Australia, for meat, dairy, eggs, lots of all the things that we have kind of these particular concerns around.
That'll tell you where to buy it as well?
Not all of them do, but you can go to their websites. Mm-hmm. So that's a great resource. I guess one of the places you do see meat like ours get really expensive is when somebody sells it through, like, your free-range butcher mate, because by the time you've had the producer's costs and now the butcher's costs put on top of it, it does get a lot more expensive in many cases. When you're buying it directly from farmers, typically it won't be, as Richard says. If it's more expensive at all, it won't be by a lot. $30 a chop, I only charge $28. But the probably more profound point there anyway is that I know it's hard for people to get their head around, but the cheapness of industrial meat comes with an enormous amount of costs in healthcare and social costs to workers and environmental degradation. And all those sorts of farms, if you can call them that, are externalizing those costs back to the public. You know, in America right now, North Carolina just flooded, and that has the highest concentration of intensive piggeries in America. What do you think happens when you flood an intensive piggery? Not only did a whole bunch of pigs drown in those sheds, their effluent ponds, or lagoons, as they call them, like it's someplace you want to swim.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of kinky Gilligan's Island.
Yes, so that's all entered all their waterways, and now they're going to have not only the massive health and environmental costs that you would expect from that, the public will foot the bill to clean it up. So It may be cheaper at the moment of point of sale, but it's simply not for society. And that's, it's hard for people to kind of make that front of mind awareness when they're shopping. We were on a very limited income when we were younger, and we just bought less meat and we bought better meat. You know, that's the mantra of slow meat, eat better meat less.
Or
eat chickpeas.
Unfortunately, it goes back to knowing how to cook as well.
Yes.
Where were we? One of my daughters was asking me something about bread and bread with a meal or potatoes with a meal, because you have lots of potatoes, lots of bread, lots of rice to go back with a meal, a stew, and the stew gets pumped up, pushed up to feed more people with more liquid and more vegetables, because the meat is really just the basis of it. It's not actually you're not eating a huge amount of protein in a dish like that. You know, I can make a chook. A big chook. You know, I get criticised by my mates for buying a chook that's $25, $30 for a chicken compared to an $8 chicken, which is the benchmark now set by the supermarkets. Mm. I pay roughly $30 to $40, but I can make that chook feed 12 plus people.
Mm. Another question out there. Throw your hand up if you don't mind. And here we go.
How are we, guys? I'm Chris from Macedon. Just to see if we can touch on two points, one on health and one on the environment. There's a statistic out there by the likes of Cowspiracy that to live as an omnivore, it roughly uses 18 times more land than to live as a vegan. I'm just wondering if you guys can sort of mention or talk around that at all. And the other one put out there by the likes of Food Matters around eating a plant-based diet and how that can improve your health long-term and sometimes reverse some ailments as well.
I'm sure Richard has things to say too, but I will certainly say that Cowspiracy is one of the worst films I've seen in terms of exposing the problems of industrial agriculture. There's some really good films, and that one has an enormous amount of factual errors. One of those errors, which gets repeated all the time, comes out of an FAO report called The Livestock's Longest Shadow, and it's talking about the carbon footprint of particularly beef and sheep farming, which is very real, a real problem, obviously. The report, though, its stats are entirely based on intensive animal agriculture, and so it doesn't account for systems like ours. A lot of where those the problems lie are that, you know, like in America, 60% of the grain grown there is for feed and fuel. That's a lot of grain, monocultural grain being grown for that. Vegan diets obviously use a lot of grain as well, and grain monocultures are kind of not that good for anything. So whether you're a vegan or a cow being fed it in a feedlot or an omnivore, eating a lot of that in your diet as well, anything coming from those kind of monocultures can be really problematic for the ecology but also your health. What was the second part of the question, though, about the... Oh, is it better for you? Look, I'm in support, obviously. Well, it doesn't even matter whether I'm in support. The scientific community is pretty clear that a plant-based diet is better for you than a meat-based diet. But that doesn't mean that a vegan diet is... In fact, I don't think most would support that a vegan diet is the best thing for humans. Most vegan diets include quite a lot of supplements to keep them going. So... we don't have many examples of good, healthy vegan societies, but we have plenty of vegetarian societies that still use dairy and eggs and things to keep that B12 and the other stuff in their diet.
Also, and you can be a vegan and eat horribly. You can be eating white bread and all kinds of junk.
Or even all the processed soy foods. They're just gross.
Yeah, and you can be a vegetarian who eats very well or a meat eater who eats very well. Yeah. So I think it's very much a spectrum. We probably have time for one more question out there if someone wants to throw up their hand.
Hi, my name's Mark. I'm from Melbourne. I was just wondering if you had any comments on biodynamic farming and where that sits in, or if it sits anywhere in the ethical debate.
What do you mean by biodynamic farming, if you don't mind just clarifying?
I see, we purchase biodynamic meat, and it's a bit hard to actually get a grip on what that means for the animal.
Right.
Biodynamics is a form, an elevated form of organic farming developed by Rudolf Steiner, who was a favourite of the anthro... Help me out, Max Allen?
Anthroposophical
movement, basically a really hardcore version of humanism, where humans have the ability to using their brains to transform the land from harnessing the power of the sun. Giving a little bit of a kick along, using some additional things to the soil as well. So basically, plant grows, turning sunlight into carbohydrate, back into the ground. Bugs feed it. You help those bugs by getting some cowhorn mixture, put a little bit of that on, get some other powders as well, put in the soil, and basically you're growing from the soil. So you're actually growing soil itself. But there's some other elements of that which I find really cult-like, with, you know, planting to the moon and the stars. But some people believe if you plant on, if you pick grapes on a certain day, then they're going to taste better. And the proof is in the drinking, and I think you should all go out there and try that and try some of those biodynamic wines. Some of the best wines made in Australia are biodynamic. Beef. What does it mean for the beef animals? The cows, I believe they're called. Pasture. A biodynamic farmer is going to have a diverse pasture simply because of the nature of what they do. Okay? Most beef farms will have, like, they'll have clover, subterranean clover for nitrogen. They're going to have some phalaris, which is going to add a lot of, they're like a tall grass. They're going to have some ryegrass for the seed for the protein. They're going to have a four or five different introduced species. Perhaps if they're on native pasture, they're going to have some other native pastures as well, doing similar things. But mostly, just say, in this part of the country, we've got beef and lambs, the sheep that are on introduced pasture. But what the biodynamic system does, it requires other plants in that mix. So you're going to have like plantain, which has got a deep root, and that deep tap root goes past the soil, through the subsoil, and starts picking up minerals, different other minerals from below. So the animals eating that, and they're getting like different minerals. They're getting different, perhaps more calcium, for example, better for bone strength, and they're getting. They'll pick around the pasture, and they'll dose themselves up on some things that'll help with their worms. They've got worms. They'll go and eat something that'll cure their own worms. And so, we're talking about happy animals, but we weren't talking about happy animals before. We're talking about animals being animals. You put an animal on a biodynamic pasture, and that's a cow or a sheep, and it's going to be more of a cow or a sheep. It's going to actually have a really great time out there, going around using, being the best animal it is, like being the best person you can be. They're going to be the best animal they can be. They can go around there being the truest animal. Talk about happy animals. Okay, we've got a few seconds on this. Okay, can you bear with me? Anyone got the car to go to? I will not use the word happy animal because I don't think we can quantify happiness in an animal. But I do know that animals feel fear, and I do know animals can be content. I won't eat anything that comes out of a feedlot because I've seen those animals and they look disgusting. They're all hunched over. I saw the animals with a whole herd with vaginal discharge, and they weren't in cycling. They were just sick animals. They looked really, really bad. And I made it, and I realised then that every single animal in that feedlot was not happy. And I use the term happy. Now come to it. But when an animal is slaughtered in the best condition, it's going to taste good and it's going to last really well, either as a fermented product on the shelf, and it's going to be the best for you. And when you have an animal that has not done its best in life and has been fed rubbish pasture, you know, some of those pastures are simply a conduit to put nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium from a chemical company, and those animals aren't going to be really nutritious for you. But an animal that's eating a biodynamic pasture is probably going to be the best choice you can make, I reckon. And it's got to have been handled well to the abattoir, and then if some miracle that it can have a happy death, which is impossible in the present situation, then and allowed to hang properly and age properly, that's probably going to be one of the best pieces of meat you'll eat.
I'm going to have to jump in here, Richard, because we're going to run out of time. But
you've got parking to go to baby.
I don't want to keep anybody in case they are running late for something. You are going to be signing copies of your book up the back here, so if anyone wants to come and hear more from Richard, he will be up the back there. There is a bookstore there in the corner where you can buy a copy of his wonderful book. Just on decisions I'm making, you maybe wanted to mention the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance, is that right?
Yeah, just was going to mention there's an organisation called the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance, and food sovereignty is about people's right to access culturally appropriate, nutritious and delicious foods, and all of our right to collectively determine our own food and agriculture systems. So that's what we're fighting for. I was president for the last 2 years, but I've just stepped into a different role, and the organisation is going great guns. We're running a very successful campaign at the moment, raising money for a legal defence fund to support small-scale farmers who are really struggling with unfair regulation and planning. So have a look at the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance, and the more people get involved, the more we have a chance to actually determine our own food and agriculture systems.
Fantastic. I feel like I've got to do a whole heap of Googling, and I'm feeling like everyone else out there is probably feeling the same. Thank you for being such a terrific audience. I know this is a topic that is vexed, like I said at the start, and there's probably a few moments throughout here where you wanted to throw something at us or yell out. I'm glad you didn't. Thank you. Without further ado, can you please thank the three panellists?
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.